It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Fast food workers are walking picket lines in cities across the country, including Milwaukee, to protest what they say are low wages. We'll get two perspectives on these protests coming up.
But first, we're talking about the agricultural jobs crisis in the Badger State at a time when Wisconsin lawmakers are trying to lure companies and the jobs that come with them to the state. The agriculture industry is struggling to fill thousands of open positions. As Steve Royson points out, the problem might get even worse in the next few years.
Farming isn't for everyone. The days are long and the work is often physically demanding. But right now it's quiet here on Tim Service's organic dairy farm just outside of Stoddard. Service and his crew have finished milking the cattle. The animals are busy eating. Every once in a while, one raises its head to sniff a stranger. Like many dairy farmers, Service relied on migrant workers to help with chores, but he says he was sick of the paperwork. After years of advertising for help, he finally has four local people on staff. He says farmhands are hard to find in Wisconsin.
And a lot of the major dairies have immigrant help, and they've tried. They try to get local help, and they just don't want to come in and work 8 hours straight milking cows. Milking cows is kind of a demanding job, but it's like a factory job. You stand and do the same thing for hours and hours.
And it's not just farmhands that are scarce. There are openings in ag-related professions that involve sales, teaching, repairs, and land surveying, to name just a few. According to the state, about 10% of all ag jobs in Wisconsin are unfilled. That's around 3,500. That worries Paul Larson. He's the president of the Wisconsin Agricultural Education and Workforce Development Council.
If our industry people cannot find the workers that they need, there's always, of course, potential for them to pack up and go somewhere else if they're able to. Now, not all of agriculture is able to do that. But they also are not going to be able to run at the capacity that they have the ability to or have the demand to.
Badgerland Financial offers credit services to farmers. The company has been running at near capacity, but it hasn't been easy. The company doubled its human resources staff to find high school and college students who are willing to live and work in the company's mainly rural locations. To help recruit new workers, Badgerland Financial even went so far as to move its headquarters 20 miles down the road from Baraboo to Prairie du Sac. Vice President Pat Link says the company lost a lot of quality applicants because they thought Baraboo was too rural.
I mean, we still would get what we wanted, but one of the feelings was to get a little closer to Madison. It would be a good thing.
With the number of unfilled ag jobs expected to triple by the year 2020, the state is also getting involved. The Department of Workforce Development, or DWD, along with the Wisconsin Agricultural Education and Workforce Development Council, unveiled a new page at the DWD website that features only agriculture-related jobs. Deputy Secretary Jonathan Berry says the job openings need to be filled quickly. He says the labor shortage is going to get even worse by the end of the decade because of industry growth and retirements.
That's like, come on, 6 years from now. And the skill sets that are needed, we need to start preparing the pipeline at the earliest possible date.
In an effort to recruit potential workers at a younger age, some ag companies are offering internships to students still in high school. Ag officials say time will tell if efforts like that will help address a growing crisis in the Wisconsin agriculture industry. Steve Reisom, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks to Steve for that report.
And now we're talking to Paul Larson, past chair of the Wisconsin Agricultural Education Workforce Development Council, about Wisconsin's agriculture job crisis. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Can you give us a sense how serious this ag job crisis in Wisconsin is right now?
Certainly. The Ag Ed Workforce Development Council in Wisconsin worked with the Department of Workforce Development to get a more accurate accounting of how many jobs we currently have, and then what is that market going to look like in the future. And we did that this past year as one of our council initiatives. And what we found through the Department of Workforce Development is that we had, in 2010, we had about 372,000 workers in Wisconsin. And the growth of that number is going to push us up to about 414,000 by 2020. The interesting part about that is, in addition to the growth numbers of about 42,000, almost 43,000 new folks, We're also going to have replacement needs of over 89,000 with retirees and people that decide to move out of the industry. So that puts our need at over 132,000 employees by 2020. So that's a big deal. That's a lot of people that we need to make sure that we're training and getting ready to take these jobs by 2020.
Now, when you look at those numbers, can you point to a moment where you saw that things were happening and we were trending this way, and this is part of how we got here? Do you know what happened?
Well, I think it's a common theme for a lot of industries, not only in Wisconsin, but across the nation, where we have an aging population. We have a large number of the baby boomers that are at that age of retirement or very near and are thinking, you know, it's time to move on to raise and help grandkids and that kind of thing. And we're just, you know, a bubble of folks that are going to leave the industry. That's part of it. And the other part of it is we have great growth in agriculture, particularly in Wisconsin. If not the number one industry, certainly very close to our number one industry, with over $59.6 billion of economic activity generated every year. With that in mind, we need to make sure that we're preparing students. And as an ag educator for my profession, I try to do that every day when I work with my students.
What happens if we can't fill these jobs, if the need is too great and the training mountain too steep?
Well, that's the concern that the council has. The Ag and Workforce Development Council is concerned about that because their job is to help support industry and make sure that we are trying to get as many people in the agriculture industry as we can. We want to attract, retain, and provide the premier workforce that agriculture in Wisconsin needs. That's one of our core missions. And what we're doing is we're putting together some plans to hopefully help with that and hope that industry will support us in these plans. And if it doesn't, my fear is that if industries are able, they may pack up and leave the state and go elsewhere if they're able. Now, certainly all agriculture industries can't do that because they have their infrastructure built in to the system that we have here. But maybe they're just not going to be up to capacity. Maybe they're not going to be able to meet the demand that they have and could be growing their business even more and generating more jobs in Wisconsin, which has been a key initiative for Wisconsin over the last couple of years.
So what's being done to get people interested in filling these agriculture jobs?
I think a couple things have been going on, particularly with the council initiatives. One of the first things we've done is we created what's called the whyag.com website, whyag.com. And that is a website that's designed for, originally designed for people with who are displaced from jobs. When the economy faded in the late, around 2008, there's a lot of people that were out of work. So this website was put in line. And what you do on that job is maybe you're in when the plant in Janesville closed, the GM plant closed there. There are a lot of people that were working there, and that's about the time we started thinking about this WYAG.com website. The notion of this website is you go out to WYAG.com, and there is what's called the skills matrix. So you may have all types of skills, whether that's in human resources or maybe it's welding or middle management or whatever your career skills might be, you might not even think about agriculture as an option for you. But your skill set might very well fit into many ag business jobs or other ag-related careers. Part of the problem with agriculture is we have an image problem. People hear agriculture and they think about plows and cows and sows. That's all they think about. But we're so much more than that with ag businesses and ag finance and agronomy and the green industry jobs of landscape and horticulture. So with the WYAG.com website, you enter in the skills that you have and you tell it to search, and it will match the career set that you have with potential employers or jobs in Wisconsin agriculture. And then the next step of that is connecting you to human resource pages of companies who are currently looking for positions. Some of our sponsors like McCain Foods, Wisconsin Public Service, Badgerland Financial, several others are on the website that have direct links right to their human resources page. So that's one of the things we're doing. The second part you heard a little bit about on the segment from Steve, talked about the Job Center website that's got the agriculture area as a featured link and a featured partner. So there's a big highlighted spot just about agriculture so people can become more aware of the options that are available there. The third thing that we're doing is we're outreaching to schools and kids and to the general public with a big display at Wisconsin State Fair. Again, our partner with Badgerland Financial has the Discovery Barnyard at State Fair, which you might be familiar with. And we're going to have a YAG area in there to try to make people more aware of the great opportunities that are available in agriculture. And one of the other initiatives that's coming forward from the council this year is we're going to try to reach out to school counselors, school boards, and school administration to make them aware of the great opportunities that there are in ag to potentially grow agriculture education programs throughout the state or connect students with agriculture education programs in their area so so that if their students are interested in agriculture, we can get them into a program early in high school, get them in the system and working their way up, whether it's through the technical college system or on in the university if necessary. So we're trying to do some things to stimulate and generate some interest and make more people more ag aware, I guess, in Wisconsin as we continue moving forward.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
That was Paul Larson, past chair of the Wisconsin Ag Education Workforce Development Council.
Coming up next, we'll move to the other end of our food supply, fast food restaurants, some strikes in Milwaukee and other cities around the country. We'll talk about why that happened in just a few. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Fast food workers have been walking picket lines in cities around the country, including Milwaukee.
The workers are protesting low minimum wages. They want the base wage in the fast food industry raised to $15 as opposed to the minimum wage of $7.25.
And Congresswoman Gwen Moore is behind legislation that would raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10.
Well, we want to know what you think. Should we raise the minimum wage? Why or why not? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org.
Here to explain why workers are protesting is Mike Wilder. He's with Wisconsin Jobs Now and the African American Roundtable. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Why isn't $7.25 enough for a fast food worker?
Well, because $7.25 cannot support a family. And we see all across the country low-wage workers that work in the fast food industry growingly and increasingly are not teenagers anymore. This used to be a teenage profession. It used to be a profession that was linked to teenagers trying to get more money in their pockets for a summer job or for, you know, something that they needed. But now it's for livelihood. The average age of fast food workers across the country is 28 years old, and women working in these jobs have a median age of 32 years old. And women make up two-thirds of fast food workers. So we're seeing that this sector is more and more adults trying to support themselves and their families, and $7.25 is just not going to cut it.
In these protests around the country, they're looking for a pretty big jump in a fast food wage up to $15. Is that right?
Absolutely.
Why so big?
Well, first of all, nationally, fast food workers only work about an average of 24 hours a week. So we're not looking at a whole bunch of people getting $15 an hour for 40 hours a week. We, you know, ideally, someone who works a job should be able to get the amount of hours that they need to get to support their families. But we're seeing throughout this this sector of work that workers are getting exploited and not getting the amount of hours that they need. So they're demanding $15 an hour in a union so that they can support their families.
We're going to hear another perspective in a little bit arguing against increasing wages and against increasing minimum wages. But one of the main arguments is you raise the wages, you put businesses out of business. A small business, maybe a fast food franchise owner, can't stay in business paying somebody that much.
That's an argument that is absolutely false. First of all, these corporations are racking in billions upon billions of profits each and every year. And the top eight publicly traded fast food chains, which is McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, Taco Bell, KFC, Pizza Hut, Domino's, and Papa John's, have over 180 locations here in the metro Milwaukee area. And that is a good chunk of our local economy here. If we make it so that these people are able to contribute to our local economy and actually buy things, support mom-and-pop businesses, and make sure our local economy thrives, I think that that'll be best for all of us. I think we all do better when people at the bottom and in the middle of our economic sector are doing better with their resources and able to spend that money.
Now, you mentioned that a growing number of the workers at these restaurants are older. It's not necessarily the teenage job anymore, but for many kids it is. Does raising the wage make it harder for them to get that first job?
Absolutely not. I mean, like I said, there was a study that came out that I recently read that only 17% of the profits of the income that is, McDonald's and all of these corporations are racking in are going towards people's wages and benefits. That's only 17% of the money that they're getting in. So that's not going to mess up anybody's bottom line here. I mean, we're seeing corporations making way more money than they've ever made in the history of this country. So, I think it'd be best if they are able to, you know, make sure that their workers are able to sustain themselves. The workers are the reason that they're making this money. The workers are providing these services to people. So I think it's only best that these workers are not being exploited and they're able to support their families off this income.
In just a moment, we'll talk to one of the workers involved in this protest. But first, I want to take a call from Rick in Manitowoc. Rick, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. One of the first most obvious problems with your guest's argument that you can't support a family on this minimum wage job is that the whole reason you have minimum wage jobs is they're entry-level jobs. You're not supposed to be trying to support a family on that. Get yourself a better job, strive, work hard, gain respect, and then get a better job.
Gotcha. Thanks for the call, Rick. So making the case there, this shouldn't be the job that somebody raising a family ends up with. This should be something on their way to supporting a family.
Well, if I can address that that caller by saying during the recession of 2008, over half of the jobs that were created since that recession have been low-wage jobs. The jobs that we have seen in the history of this country, like manufacturing jobs, they're not here anymore. They're gone, and a lot of them are not coming back. We have to make these jobs the good-paying jobs of the future that are able to sustain families. So in an ideal world, yeah, these jobs are entry-level, but this is not the world that we're living in now. We have an economy that is not thriving the way we want it to, and these are the jobs that we need to make good jobs, good-paying jobs that sustain families.
I'd like to talk now to one of the workers who's been involved in the protest. We have Tessie Harrell on the line. She's a single mother of six kids who's been working at Burger King for 5 years, makes, she tells us, about $8.25 an hour. Tessie, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Now tell us about raising a family on that wage, $8.25 an hour.
It's very hard to raise six children, paying bills, and a car note off $8.25 an hour, and guaranteed, you're not guaranteed 40 hours a week. You know, so you have rent to pay, you have bills to do. I mean, you have electricity to pay, and we have a choice. And I heard this one guy say that we have to have an entry level. Some people that have degrees can't even get a good paying job to support their own selves. So it's not about, to me, it's really not about if you don't have a degree, if you do have a degree. The thing is that we cannot sit here and take care of our families off of $8.25 an hour, $7.25 an hour for a minimum wage. That is very difficult for us to do when this economy prices are safe. They're always saying that prices are going to go up. Have they noticed prices are going up now and the minimum wage still stays the same?
Tessie, were you picketing yesterday?
Not yesterday. We're picketing Thursday.
You're going out Thursday. We're going
on strike. Yes.
And do you think these pickets, these protests, are going to make a difference?
I think it'll make a difference because of the fact is that we're making a stand for ourselves. I feel like if that we don't talk for ourselves or open our mouths, we won't be able to get heard. And yes, I really do believe this is going to matter, how we live or whatever, because they always say that, you know, minimum wage, $7.25 an hour is enough for us to take care of our family, do whatever. It's not. Technically, our checks are $400 to $500 every pay period. Our rent is $600 and some. Our electricity bill is $100. We have kids to buy shoes for. We have kids to buy clothes for. We have to provide them, you know, with different, we have to provide materialistic stuff as far as, you know, tissue, household items, different stuff that we can't provide off of a minimum wage job making $7.25 an hour. That's why we deserve that $15 an hour. It's more than we do in those restaurants than these people actually see on the other side of the counter.
Tessie,
you know,
thank you.
We get up at 5 o'clock.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, we get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go to work, and we work hard for this. And I just feel like that they actually need to increase minimum wage at least from $7.25 to $10 to $15 an hour, a livable wage for us to be able to take care of our kids so we don't wind up either homeless or either wind up just being without electricity or something.
Tessie, thank you so much for joining us. And Mike Wilder, just 30 seconds before I let you go, is her story common?
Absolutely. Well, so, you know, just to reiterate, workers that are dependent on government assistance. And I would actually tell that caller that called into you, don't we want less people on Badger Care? Don't we want less people on food share? Don't we want less people on W-2 and all these government taxpayer-funded programs? Don't we want people to be able to sustain themselves so they don't have to be subsidized by the taxpayers? These are companies, McDonald's. $8.81 billion in revenue last year. Burger King, $1.26 billion in domestic revenue. These are companies that have the money to pay these workers, and I think they should pay them so that they can support their families.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Mike Wilder with Wisconsin Jobs Now and the African-American Roundtable. Thanks also to Tessie Harrell, who's going to be protesting on Thursday. More to come after this break. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time.
I'm Rob Ferret. In cities across the country, fast food workers are going on one-day strikes against the minimum wage. They say they should be paid about twice what they're getting now.
We just heard from Mike Wilder of Wisconsin Jobs Now about why he says we should raise the minimum wage. And we want to know what you think. Should the minimum wage be raised? Why or why not? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us your email to talk@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation now. We have Diana Furchtgott-Roth, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, with us. She says we should not raise the minimum wage. Diana, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you today.
So we have these protesters at fast food restaurants saying we are, some of us, trying to raise families. We need a living wage. We need to be paid as much as twice what we're being paid now. What's your response?
Well, my response is that if the wage is raised, then many of the people that have these jobs will not have them. About half of minimum wage workers are under 25. About 58% of them work part-time. Quite a lot of them work in the leisure and hospitality industry. About half of these workers are in the leisure and hospitality industry. And the number of minimum wage workers in the United States is relatively small, about 3.8 million workers, or about 2.8% of total. So it's not a large problem. But we have 97% of workers in the United States being paid more than minimum wage, not because there's any regulation, but because employers have to pay them more in order to retain them. So it's mostly the young and the unskilled who are working at minimum wage jobs. If we raise the minimum wage, they will find it harder to get employment. And already the teen unemployment rate's about 23%. The African-American teen unemployment rate is 44%.
But about half of the workers you said at these jobs are younger, but that means half of them aren't. A lot of them are older, might want to raise families. Don't they need some kind of good-paying job? There's not maybe a manufacturing job, not a high-paying job out there for a lot of these people. Don't we need jobs that pay a living wage for them to raise a family?
Well, 97% of employees in the United States are paid more than minimum wage. So if you have the skills to get a higher-paying job, you go out and get one of these higher-paying jobs. The point is that these are entry-level jobs for people who don't have the skills to get higher-paying jobs. So there are teens, for example, that are making $7.25 an hour. And if the wage were raised to, say, $10 or $15 an hour, fewer of those people would be employed. It is a serious problem if we have people who cannot make ends meet. Please don't misunderstand me. But we have food stamps. We have housing vouchers. We have earned income tax credit. We have other programs to supplement these individuals' income. If we force employers to pay more than the job is worth, employers are going to react by not hiring or reducing hiring or substituting machines for individuals, for workers.
I saw an article today that it's Henry Ford's birthday, and that he was an employer who said, you know what, we need to pay workers more so they can go out and buy stuff and sustain the economy. And now the protesters, the people criticizing the current minimum wage, are saying, well, you have businesses making more and more money, like Henry Ford did, but they're not. That's not passing down to their lowest level workers. We're seeing rising inequality. Do you think we need to go back to a Henry Ford model, or are things working pretty well now?
Well, 97% of non-farm payroll workers are paid above minimum wage. So the
some people are being paid a little above minimum wage.
So the vast majority of workers are being paid above minimum wage. Henry Ford was able to pay his workers more because they were on assembly lines. They were high productivity. He didn't pay them more out of the goodness of his heart. He paid them more to retain them. And that's why you, for example, that's why NPR is paying you what they're paying you right now. They're not paying minimum wage because if they paid you minimum wage, you would go off and find another job with CBS or NBC or some other radio station. So, but if it were mandated by the government that you were paid, just for example, you know, $300 an hour, then probably NPR would decide that they could do with fewer news analysts, fewer people to run their programs. There is always a backlash right there. If $10 an hour is good, why not $20 an hour? Why not $30 an hour? The answer, of course, is because then there is an effect on employment and employers have fewer people. We're already seeing this with the minimum wage for teens. There's an unemployment rate of 23 or 24%. It's a vast social problem when young people can't get jobs, and by raising the minimum wage, we're pricing them out of the labor market.
Some other developed countries that people point to have higher minimum wages, Scandinavia, Australia, and they don't necessarily have lower unemployment rates than the U.S. Can higher minimum wages be made to work?
Higher minimum wages, they can be made to work. They can be made to work for employers. They can be made to work for the economy. But you have this group of young, unskilled workers who cannot get their foot on the first rung of the career ladder. You also have to look at how the minimum wage workers are distributed among different states. So a minimum wage goes further in Georgia, for example, than in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, 4.6 of workers in 2011 earned minimum wage. In Georgia, it was 9.6. Georgia, North Carolina, Texas, West Virginia, they have lower costs than Wisconsin, and a higher proportion of their employees are on minimum wage. So you also have to look at regional distributions and how far a dollar goes in different parts of the country.
I want to bring our callers in now. We've got David with us in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Yes. Part of the reason is such a low tax rate on the super rich. I mean, under Eisenhower, Republican president, the top tax rate used to be 93%. At that rate, when they're making billions of dollars, most of it went back to the government, and therefore they didn't have an incentive to squeeze employees' wages so much. But now, if they squeeze the employees' wages, they get to keep most of that. I say we need to go back to higher. Also, I would like to see, instead of a minimum wage, how about a tax credit for hiring Americans at $30,000 a year? So every American you hire at that, you get a nice tax credit. And raise the rates up so if you don't want taxes, you just hire a bunch of people. Otherwise, you pay high taxes.
All right, David, thanks for the call. Let's start with that second point first, Diana. A tax incentive for hiring Americans at a higher rate.
These are all possible. The problem is what kind of worker you're going to choose. So say you have a tax incentive for hiring somebody above the minimum wage, but then you choose a more skilled worker who you might have hired anyway. So these tax credits, it's very hard to get people to do what you want them to do for the tax credit and not get around it. And as to the caller's other question, the top tax rate's about 42% on the federal level. The average state tax is 9% for a total individual income tax of over 50%. The 93% rate he was referring to was paid by very, very few people.
And that was the wartime tax that was still held over, wasn't it?
Exactly, yes.
Thanks for the call, David. We'll go back to the phones now with Nick in Algoma. Hi, Nick.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I worked in McDonald's for a little over 8 years, and those people, they work very, very hard for not a lot of money, but I don't think raising the, what do you want to call it,
the wage, the minimum wage?
Yeah, minimum wage. That's not going to solve the problem. I think the companies that are making, you know, McDonald's makes how many billions of dollars a year, they should pay their employees more so they don't have such a high turnover rate and they have better quality of employees. And I don't think that saying, well, you know, put them, well, it's okay. They get paid a little bit. They can go on welfare. They can go on food stamps. Well, that puts the burden on everybody else. I mean, I worked there for a long time. I ended up, it's very easy to get trapped in that kind of job because that's your only skills is that kind of job. I actually went out, started my own little business, basically, and then ended up getting a different job with those sets of skills. So I just don't think raising the minimum wage is going to help, but they do need to be paid more because they work really hard. And I have met some of the best people I've ever met and also some of the laziest, worst people I've ever met.
Well, but Nick, it sounds like your success story. The low wage gave you an incentive to go out, start a business,
exactly.
Get skills that got you out ahead.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Nick. What do you make of his story, Diana?
Well, I started off in fast food, too. I started off, my first paying job was scooping ice cream at Baskin-Robbins, that was the best job I could get at the time. Then I moved up to other kinds of positions. And at that time, if there would been a higher minimum wage, I probably would not have got the job that I had. I was grateful for it at the time. It gave me the income I needed over the summer. And if you raise wages that McDonald's is required to pay, then it's very likely that the cost of the Big Macs and the shakes is going to go up also. That's also going to affect people who just want an inexpensive, filling meal. Also, if you have higher minimum wages for McDonald's and other large chains, then small restaurants are going to be at a competitive advantage and people are going to go to Joe's Diner or Emily's Eatery rather than going to McDonald's. So it certainly doesn't make any sense to say large corporations have to pay more than other companies.
Diana, we started this off because some people are calling for a higher minimum wage and higher base wages. Do you think we'd be better off with a lower minimum wage or no minimum wage at all?
I think we'd be better off with no minimum wage at all, exactly, because right now with $7.25 an hour, plus employers have to pay Social Security, workers' compensation, unemployment insurance, that adds up to about $8 an hour. And so what we have is a law in the United States that say if you have skills under $8 an hour, you are not allowed to be hired. There are, as I said, 97% of people make above minimum wage, but it's those 2 or 3% at the bottom with low skills that we have to make sure they have their foot on the first rung of the career ladder. It affects a small number of people, but it's the small number of people who most need a job. It's an immense social problem when people cannot get a job and get their foot into the labor force and enable them to work up. And we need to make sure that for the sake of economic mobility, people can get into the workforce.
Diana, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again on the Ideas Network.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
That's Diana Furchtgott-Roth, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We've been talking about protests in Milwaukee and other cities at fast food restaurants calling for higher minimum wage and higher wages in the industry.
Coming up, we'll be speaking to a reporter about how outdoor smoking bans are turning smokers into pariahs. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And thank you so much, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Coming up after 5, would introverts be happier if they acted more like extroverts? Our guest has done some research on that question.
First, a look at smoking and smoking bans. Our guest wrote a piece on outdoor smoking bans, their impact and their history, and says they might be helping turn smokers into pariahs.
We want to hear what you think. Do you have an outdoor smoking ban in place somewhere in your community? Do you wish you did? Do you want to see fewer places allow smoking or... are we making life unfair for smokers? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Emily Badger joins us now. She's a staff writer at the Atlantic Cities, and we've linked to her article on the Central Time Facebook page. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a bit of the backstory on outdoor smoking bans? How long have they been around?
Sure. Well, there's an organization called the American Non-Smokers' Rights Foundation, which has been keeping tabs on these smoking bans for pretty much as long as anyone knows that they've been around. And the first one that they found cropped up in 1975 in Davis, California. This was a ban that basically said no one can smoke in public parks anywhere in the county there. And at the time, this wasn't really an idea that caught on. It was really another 20 or so years that passed before we started to see a lot more of these, first in California and then around the rest of the country, not just in public parks, but also in public beaches, and then in a lot of other sort of semi-public commercial spaces that we associate more with smoking bans, like restaurants and bars.
So obviously this was something that has caught on. Is the turning of the tide there just awareness of health? What happened to make it catch on so quickly?
Well, I think that sort of what's gradually happened has been this process of just totally changing the social norms about how we think about smokers. I mean, I think of New York City as being a really sort of great case study of how this has happened. That's a city that, you know, just 10 years ago first proposed having a smoking ban in bars and restaurants there. And at the time, this was a really controversial idea. And now this is an extremely popular policy. You know, people take for granted that there are all these places that you can go in the city without having to encounter people who are smoking. And all of these sort of bans cumulatively over time, I think, have really sort of changed our thinking about where we can expect to go without encountering smokers, sort of changed our thinking about where people should be smoking, and it's even sort of changed our thinking about whether or not people should be smoking in the first place. And that's just sort of, I think this gradual process is really kind of fundamentally changing social norms about how we view these people.
Well, I think in large part, I can remember when it became popular and there was so much awareness about secondhand smoke and health data saying it caused cancer, that there was just as big a risk with secondhand smoke as there was if you were a smoker yourself. And then if you translate that data to the out-of-doors, does it still hold? Do we know what the health impact is there?
Well, I think obviously part of our sort of changing attitudes about this has to do with the fact that we're much better informed now about what the health consequences of smoking are. But the reality is that particularly with a lot of these outdoor bans, particularly in public parks and on beaches, for instance, there isn't quite as much sort of science to back up why these are smart policies, and in the same way that there's some science that suggests, you know, that some other ways of curbing smoking, you know, such as raising cigarette taxes or sort of changing advertising on cigarettes might kind of change how people use them. And, you know, I was writing about this in the context of some public health researchers who were really sort of concerned that some of these bans stand on sort of some shaky science that's not quite as firm as people think that it is, and that's not really the best basis for creating public health policy.
So you're saying the science doesn't back up all the outdoor bans?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of three main arguments that people use for why we need to have outdoor bans. I mean, one of them is this sort of secondhand smoke concern, and one of them is, you know, this notion that cigarettes butts create this kind of toxic litter that's really bad for the environment. And then there's this sort of behavioral argument as well that, you know, we don't want people out smoking in public where children might see them because we don't want children to be sort of, you know, getting these ideas that smoking is a good idea and they're young and impressionable and might they grow up to do this too. And so, you know, sort of if you pick apart kind of the data behind each of those three arguments, you know, secondhand smoke in sort of outdoor public places does not, you know, this isn't to say that it isn't bad for people, but the data sort of showing exactly what the consequences are is really not quite as strong as I think a lot of advocates argue that it is. And, you know, on the other two topics, there simply isn't a lot of research that sort of says that cigarette butts are doing significant damage to the environment. And there also isn't a lot of research suggesting that, you know, impressionable children are really heavily influenced by seeing people smoke in public.
Now, you use the word pariah, that is, if you wrote the headline, as to what happens with these policies and all of these outdoor bans that have become so prevalent everywhere. I mean, is that a fair word to use, pariah?
Well, I think that these policies are all targeting the behavior of smoking. But, you know, you can't sort of ignore the fact that in targeting the behavior of smoking, you also inadvertently sort of target the people who are doing that behavior. And I think the sort of consequence of all of this over time is that as we've created fewer and fewer places where it's okay to be smoking, you know, we've also created sort of this perception that it's not okay to be a smoker. And, you know, whether or not this is sort of an intentional aim of these policies or just sort of an inadvertent consequence is, I think, sort of an important question anytime we're talking about creating new public health policies around whether or not to ban smoking. I mean, do we want to ban smoking because we actually think that it will improve the health for people around you? Or do we want to ban smoking because we're actually trying to sort of denormalize this as an activity because we want fewer people to do it because we want the smokers themselves to become healthier?
I want to take a phone call now. Let's go to Kara, who's joining us in Cedarburg. Hi, Kara.
Hi.
What do you think about smoking bans? Oh, we lost you just at the moment. Well, feel free to call back and we'll see if we can get you in, Kara. And has there been much pushback, Emily, about these kinds of bans? Are people sort of asking the same questions you're asking and wanting to feel like it's okay to be a smoker if that's my choice?
Yeah, I mean, well, certainly sort of to come back to that initial example I gave of when these policies were first instituted in New York 10 years ago, I mean, there was a lot of pushback against this idea. I mean, sort of what we see around a soda ban in New York today is sort of what we saw around smoking bans in New York 10 years ago. And, you know, that was both this notion that sort of people should be, you know, free to do this where they want to in public. It's technically a legal activity, so why would we sort of constrain people's ability to do a legal activity in public? But then, you know, there's also concerns that, you know, in places that have instituted smoking bans, particularly like in restaurants and bars, that this will be bad for business, that people won't go to bars, that people won't go to restaurants. And I think it's sort of a legitimate concern that I can understand, although I'm not a smoker myself, that you might sort of come to feel kind of stigmatized by these policies if you are one.
And I think that, in general, people who don't smoke have gotten used to there being smoking bans in just about every public place. And how hard is it, do you think, to roll back this kind of thing?
Oh, I'm pretty confident that we probably won't ever see these things rolled back. I mean, I sort of think of, you know, my own shock when you get on an airplane and realize that there are no smoking signs on the airplane because there was a time when people used to be able to smoke on airplanes. And, you know, our sort of visceral reaction to that idea is so kind of palpable and dramatic now that I think it's highly unlikely that we will ever see smoking sort of reintroduced into these spaces and even these public spaces where smoking has been eliminated.
I think we have time for one quick call. Rick in Wauwatosa. Real quickly, please, Rick, what's your comment?
Sure, real quick. It seems like society as a whole, the people that don't do the thing force the people that do the things into their way of thinking. Just a quick illustration. Mothers Against Drunk Driving, you don't see them protesting about cell phone use, and we now know that cell phone use is as bad, if not worse, than drunk driving, and it's because they use cell phones while they drive. I think smoking, I can understand inside a bar or inside a restaurant, you don't want to force that on somebody else, but now you're not even allowing them to smoke in the back of a restaurant or somewhere else in the bar. I think we're infringing a little too far now. We're getting too much where those that don't do it are forcing too much onto those that do.
All right. Thank you, Rick. And Emily, we've got about 15 seconds for a response there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And the question is sort of at the end of the day, are people who don't smoke trying to protect themselves because they think secondhand smoke is harmful? Or are they really trying to change the behavior of people who are smoking because we've sort of decided as a society that we just don't want people to do this?
Well, Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Emily Badger, staff writer at the Atlantic Cities.
Coming up, would introverts be happier if they acted like extroverts? There's some new research, and we'll talk about it coming up. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.